Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's remarks in response to the latest mass shooting at a Texas church, where he blamed the problem on mental health, not access to military-style assault rifles, and rejected the idea of improving background checks when clearly the Texas shooter would have failed a background check had the Air Force not screwed up and passed on the shooter's criminal record of domestic abuse to the FBI database. Congressman Ted Lieu joins us first. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and today walked out of the moment of silence on the House floor to protest inaction on a universal background check law and a ban on assault rifles and on bump fire stocks. Then Paul Helmke, a professor in the School of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University, who was formerly the president of the Brady Campaign to Stop Gun Violence, joins us to refute Donald Trump's NRA talking points, in particular his claim that Chicago has the strongest gun laws in the country, yet is a disaster, when in fact it was the NRA who weakened Chicago's gun laws. Furthermore, the guns used in crimes in Chicago almost all come from Indiana next door, where gun laws are weak and straw purchases are commonplace. Then we look into the impending default by oil-rich Venezuela following last Thursday's announcement by President Maduro that the country he has brought to its knees with a combination of corruption, mismanagement, and mindless ideology can no longer pay its debts. The founding director of the Center for Energy and Environment at IESA in Venezuela, Francisco Manaldi, now a fellow in Latin American Energy Policy at the Center for Energy Studies in the Mexico Center and the Latin American Initiative, as well as a lecturer in energy economics at Rice University. He joins us to discuss how Maduro has mortgaged bankrupt Venezuela's $15 trillion in oil wealth, first to China and now to Russia, and how much Trump's threat of an invasion has helped Maduro cling on to power. Then finally, as results come in on the critical bellwether race for governor in Virginia, we will speak with Quentin Kidd, professor of political science at Christopher Newport University in Virginia. We'll discuss the ruthless and shameless campaign that the Republican Gillespie has run and the feckless campaign the conservative Democrat who voted for George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004, Lieutenant Governor Northam, ran after narrowly beating a progressive Democrat in the primary. And joining us now is Congressman Ted Lieu, who was elected in 2014 to California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was also appointed as an assistant whip for the Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Ted Lieu.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thank you for joining us, Congressman. And you took a very brave and bold step today, walking out on a moment of silence in the House. I imagine some people, perhaps a lot of people, will misconstrue that as being disrespectful to those who were murdered in the church in Texas.
Well, let me first say that when I saw the news coming out of Texas on Sunday, it was horrifying. And I have two children. They're 14 and 11. I can only imagine the pain and grief of people losing their kids. 26 people died, including, you know, very small children. I happen to be Christian. I prayed for them that day. But I'm not going to go do another moment of silence on the floor of the House of Representatives for 60 seconds. We've had way too many of them since I've been a member of Congress. There has been over 1,000 mass shootings, consider four or more people dying at once, and we've had over 20 moments of silence, and there's been exactly zero votes on gun safety legislation. So I'm just not going to participate anymore in moments of silence, because I think we need to speak up and demand action on reasonable gun safety legislation.
Well, I detect the frustration that in your voice, and I recall President Obama after the Sandy Hook massacre of young school, elementary school children, he was in tears, as a matter of fact, in frustration that he couldn't get anything passed. So it's clearly, it's almost a kind of macabre version of Groundhog Day here, isn't it? We keep seeing the same bad movie over and over again.
We do, and I myself have participated in every moment of silence on the House floor until now, because I realize I just can't keep doing this, seeing no action in Congress. And there's reasonable gun safety legislation, such as a B ban on bump stocks, a ban on assault rifles, and universal background checks. In fact, the universal background checks bill has over 90% support among the American public. That is an amazing number. Unfortunately, the House Republican leadership refuses to let that legislation come to the floor, and I'm simply speaking up to say we need to have action. And instead of sitting around doing nothing, we need to do our jobs in Congress.
Well, I found it extraordinary that the president in South Korea, in response to questions about the massacre, the latest massacre in Texas, basically said he's almost parroted the NRA's mantra that the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, and referred to the citizen who shot the wounded shooter, and that had and basically was in fact furthering that kind of myth, whereas it would seem so obvious and logical that the reason that this happened in large part was because that this fellow got by a background check because of a screw-up in terms of the Air Force in not passing on his criminal record to the database. So isn't what just happened more than anything else an example of how background checks saves lives?
Absolutely. And on the House Judiciary Committee, in which I sit, we have jurisdiction over the background checks database. There was a report from the FBI last year that showed among all their military services in the Department of Defense, they reported exactly one case of domestic violence for a conviction. That simply cannot be true. So we're calling for hearings on this issue in Congress. I believe it is a Department of Defense-wide problem where, for whatever reason, the military branches are not reporting domestic violence convictions to this database. I think one of the reasons actually is because there's actually no specific domestic violence offense in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I served on active duty in the Air Force. I prosecuted court martials. I was a JAG. And maybe when people try and translate these offenses into what should be reported database, you have problems going on. So we're working on legislation to create a specific domestic violence offense in the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
But back to the paralysis in the House and in the Congress in general, and we certainly in Donald Trump do not have a president who is in favor of any kind of gun safety. In fact, he proudly said that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. What will it take basically a citizen's lobby for gun safety that is as powerful or in fact more powerful than the NRA to basically frighten legislators into doing the right thing?
That would be helpful, but in exactly 1 year, voters across America get to vote again on the makeup of Congress. If they change the makeup of Congress, then we can pass reasonable gun safety legislation. I think it's helpful to note that two additional Republicans announced a retirement today, Ted Poe out of Texas and also Frank Lobiondo. And if we can change the makeup of Congress, then I think we can get some legislation through. And just one quick note, listeners aren't confused. The reason I mentioned domestic violence is because under law, if you're convicted of domestic violence, you're prohibited from owning a firearm.
Well, this was definitely a case of domestic violence. His young stepchild, I think, was only a year old, had a fractured skull as a result of his violence. So it's a pretty horrific thing that somehow slipped through the cracks, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I am pleased that their Air Force Secretary has directed the Chief of Staff of the Air Force to do an immediate investigation into what happened. But again, I think this is actually a Department of Defense-wide problem, just based on the report from last year showing that no other service actually reported domestic violence convictions either.
Well, just in closing, Congressman Liu, Paul Ryan and Governor Abbott both have gone public and said that they believe that you can pray away evil. And I frankly, I can't I can't sort of subscribe to that, because surely by doing nothing about these repetitive mass shootings and gun massacres, you are enabling evil.
I believe in prayer. I do prayer. But clearly, if that was enough, then we would not have had three of the worst mass shootings in U.S. history happen since I became a member of Congress in 2015. We're actually seeing an increase in mass shootings, so clearly thoughts and prayers and moments of silence are not doing the job. We actually need to pass legislation. And keep in mind, other civilized countries have done far better in reducing gun violence. Australia had a massacre. Then they passed gun safety legislation to ban basically automatic weapons, and they haven't had a mass shooting since.
Well, Congressman Ted Lieu, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Congressman Ted Lieu, who was elected in 2014 to California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was also appointed as an assistant whip for the Democratic Caucus. And joining us now is Paul Helmke, a professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, and the former president of the Washington, D.C.-based Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, a nonpartisan grassroots organization leading the fight to prevent gun violence. He's also the former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and the former president of the United States Conference of Mayors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Helmke.
It's good to talk to you, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Paul. And what do you make of this sort of strange disconnect where President Trump is basically saying that the shooter in Texas, the tragedy is all about mental health problems. And then when asked in South Korea about extreme vetting in terms of guns, he's rejected that idea and said that basically, I'll quote what he said, if you did what you're suggesting, there would have been no difference 3 days ago. And you might not have had that very brave person who happened to have a gun in his truck and shoot him and hit him and neutralize him. So Donald Trump is using the NRA talking points, which are that the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is to have a good guy with a gun shoot him, which is what happened here. But what Trump is not dealing with, and in, obviously didn't answer that question, isn't it pretty clear that the fact that this guy, that the Air Force screwed up with the background check, is really the reason why this could have been prevented? In other words, doesn't it prove that background checks work?
Yeah, this is a great example of why we have the Brady Bill, why we have the background check system, why we have a list of prohibited purchasers, and why we as a country decided that there are certain people that shouldn't have guns. This is a case that touches on mental illness, because this is somebody that apparently had been found to be a danger to himself or others by the courts at one stage. He was someone who had been involved in domestic violence. And both of those, being in danger to yourself or others, having domestic violence restraining orders against you, as well as some versions of dishonorable discharge from the military, all three of those things are covered by the prohibited purchaser list. And with the prohibited purchaser list, if background checks are done and done properly, the person shouldn't be able to get the gun. But one of the problems that we see, and we saw this with Virginia Tech too, is that we don't always have complete information in the computer database. With the Virginia Tech shooter, Virginia had found him to be a danger to himself or others, didn't send the information in. With this Texas shooting, we had the same thing. He'd been found to be a danger to himself or others, had been dishonorably discharged, involved in domestic violence, but for some reason, the military didn't send the record in. That's that shows why we need a stronger background check system. When something bad happens, you don't give up on the law. You say, how can we make the law stronger? And here it's let's figure out how we make sure the military gets this information in there. And to say that somehow having a strong background check system, having the restrictions on the books that we already have and that we need more of, would stop the good guys from getting the gun makes no sense at all. The good guys will pass the background checks. The good guys will be able to get the gun. And somehow the president seems to think that having the kind of restrictions that we have in place now would take away their guns makes it just nonsensical. I'm all for a good guy with a gun being able to help. But I'd like to prevent these shootings from happening in the first place, and I think that's what the president and what our other elected officials should try to do. Let's prevent this gun violence. Let's prevent these mass shootings. Instead, we've had two of the five worst mass shootings in modern U.S. history happen within just the last month and a half. Something's wrong here. We're not doing things right. Having more guns is not the answer. Having better gun restrictions is part of the answer.
And Paul Helmke, what do you think about the politics? Since you headed up the Brady campaign to prevent gun violence, you've obviously been involved in this for decades. It's very frustrating for people. I recalled President Obama in tears after he couldn't get anything passed after the Sandy Hook. We know about the NRA. They obviously were a little rattled by the massacre in Las Vegas and even conceded maybe that bump stocks were a bad idea. But now I read that the manufacturers of firearms and bump stocks are back in business. They had a temporary pause, but now they're back in business. So what is this pattern here? Massacre, murder, mayhem, and then offering up prayers, which is what happened today in the Congress, and then nothing getting done.
I agree with you. It's very frustrating. It's very easy to just wonder if anything's ever going to happen. I know a lot of people that, Sandy Hook and having 20 first graders riddled with 10 bullets each wasn't enough to make us do something. What will? But I continue to think that eventually, at least the American people, we'll let their elected officials know that this is important to them. I think when we start seeing these things occurring with increasing frequency and in increasing levels of lethality with the number of dead and the number of wounded, I think eventually folks are going to start saying, what are you going to do about it? You see 9 people killed in a terrorist attack in New York City, and no one says, gee, evil will always be here, and terrorists will find another way. If we stop planes, they'll get trucks. If we stop trucks, they'll get motorcycles. People will say, do something to stop the terrorist attacks. And I think eventually folks will start saying, do something to stop the mass shootings. Do something to stop this level of violence. Have stronger background check systems, which when you poll even, the NRA members and gun owners support, do things to strengthen ATF. I think the American people eventually are going to make their opinions known to their elected officials, and elected officials are going to realize they can't run behind, I support the Second Amendment, or let's have more prayers type thing. You can't keep doing that. We're now seeing it every few weeks. I think I read a statistic the other day. It used to be, in the 70s, you'd see a mass shooting maybe once a year. Then it would move to once, twice a year. Now we're seeing it almost once every other month or so. And at that sort of level, I think people are going to speak up and let their electeds to do something. And if they don't, they're going to change the people they put in office.
Well, actually, I think the definition for mass shootings is where 4 people get killed, 4 or more. Mm-hmm. I was watching the news last night, and I think they said that it's almost once every day or once a week.
It depends on which definition you're using. But in the big mass public shootings, the one that gets our attention now, those are at whatever definition you're using, they're occurring more frequently. And I think that shows pretty clearly that what we're doing now isn't working. When I talk to the young people that I teach, and I have a lot of freshmen mainly, and I just did an interview with some high school students, they don't understand why our elected officials don't do anything. And, some of these young people are from gun-owning families in rural areas in Indiana. But they realize that this doesn't make sense, and that we shouldn't continue allowing this sort of thing to happen and just keep throwing up our hands and saying nothing can be done. The one argument I used to hear is, gun control doesn't work, and my response has always been, how do we know? We haven't tried it yet in this country.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Helmke, who's a professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University and the former president of the Washington, D.C.-based Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, a nonpartisan grassroots organization leading the fight to prevent gun violence. He's also the former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and former president of the United States Conference of Mayors. Now, earlier when you said that you were supported the idea of having more good guys with guns coming to the rescue, isn't that a little problematic, though? I mean, you need people that are trained like police, citizens with guns.
And I what I was referring to is certainly when a good guy with a gun uses it to stop the bad guy, I'm not complaining about that situation. But the problem, you know, having run a police department, having dealt with law enforcement issues, I know how hard it is for law enforcement to do things properly and do it right. When police officers are in shootout situations, they only hit their target 20% of the time. And so it's hard for the private citizen to take on this responsibility. You don't have the training in marksmanship generally. The individual in Texas may have. You don't have the psychological testing on a regular basis. But certainly, if a good guy can stop something from happening, more power to them. It's just that's a heavy risk and a heavy responsibility. And what it usually ends up doing is frustrating law enforcement. We had this recent shooting in the Walmart north of Denver, Colorado, a few days ago. One of the things that came out was the fact that a lot of people in the store pulled their private guns, didn't use them to shoot the bad guy. They just pulled their private guns, made it harder for the police to determine who the bad guy was and track him down. So oftentimes the good guy, the so-called good guy with the gun, makes it harder for the police to do their job. We had a similar situation, and then you get the shootings like the Las Vegas shooting. The good guy with a gun can do nothing when the person has a gun that can shoot three football fields away from, a high up floor of a hotel and kill all sorts of people. So there are limits to what somebody with a gun can do. And even in the Las Vegas situation, some of the reports were that the police, have trouble when they go into a situation and they see other people carrying guns. It makes, the police don't automatically know who the good guys are and the bad guys are. And that's why it's dangerous to have these situations. But again, the people involved in the Texas shooting, you've got to be, they did the right thing there. They gave chase, and while they weren't the ones that killed the guy who committed suicide, it probably helped bring the situation to the end. I'm not sure it stopped hundreds of other deaths, like the president seemed to say. And again, those good guys would have not have been stopped by the kind of rules we're talking about. The guy goes back in his house and gets his weapon. This idea that we need everyone carrying guns around with them in church, in the nightclubs, at the concerts, in the schools, that's just a recipe for more danger, because the studies do show that the more guns that you have in a situation, in a city, a county, a state, a country, the more guns in a situation, the more gun violence you're going to have. And that's the problem we're dealing with.
Well, let's discuss another one of Donald Trump's remarks today in response to questions about this gun massacre in the small town in Texas, where the churchgoers, 26 were killed, 20 are wounded, 10 in critical condition. Trump said that, talking about Chicago, he said, "The city with the strongest gun laws in our nation is Chicago, and Chicago is a disaster, a total disaster." So how do you refute that? Because that's obviously, a lot of people think Trump's right.
Well, two things. First of all, I'm not sure Chicago has the strongest gun laws in the country anymore. That's one of the target cities that the NRA and the gun rights crowd went after in the courts. And, the two cities that had strong gun laws were D.C. and Chicago. And the D.C. versus Heller case took away D.C.'s strong gun laws, or at least the gun laws that they'd had on the books up to 2008. And in 2010, the McDonnell versus Chicago case gutted Chicago's strong gun laws. So, in effect, the gun rights group has already gotten rid of the strong gun laws in Chicago. And, of course, they told us once they did that, then the city would be safer. And apparently, getting rid of the strong gun laws hasn't worked. But, Chicago still does have some good gun laws. The problem is that the guns in Chicago come from places like my state of Indiana. Indiana has weak gun laws, and it's been estimated that something like 25% of the guns used in crime in the city of Chicago come from Indiana, because it's easy to get guns in Indiana, and we don't stop people at the border between Indiana and Illinois, and they're right next there, and that's part of the problem. And that's what happens in this country. Whether a city has strong gun laws or a state has strong gun laws, as long as we do nothing at the national level, which is what we do after every mass shooting, is to do nothing at the national level, then we're going to see more more guns moved from the states with weak gun laws to the other states where it's hard to get a gun. States move up from the south into New York. States move from into D.C. and guns move in. I mean, guns move into those states, and guns move into Chicago the same way.
Well, both the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, speaking on one of the morning TV shows, was asked about, he kept saying that we just got to pray. And one of the women on the panel said, well, but, you know, prayer is one thing, but what about action? What about doing something? And Abbott seemed a little indignant, because I believe he's a very devout Christian, if that's the correct description. He was indignant and basically said, but prayer works. It's the only way to get rid of evil. And the same thing was pretty much echoed by the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. And as you know, they did a moment of silence today in the House. So these increasingly hollow gestures, these offering prayers without wanting to offer any solutions, as though somehow this is some sort of divine situation. How could it be in anything but a diabolical situation? I do not understand the religiosity of accepting such an unacceptable situation.
And I agree with your perspective here. It's I have nothing against prayer, but prayer without action is hypocrisy. You know, it's faith without deeds is the same sort of thing, and it's just, you know, it's we don't need more prayer. We need Congress to do something. We need our elected officials to step up to the plate. The people that were mowed down here in this church, as well as the Charleston church a couple of years ago, as well as the Sikh temple a few years before that, they were praying. And we need someone to make it harder for dangerous people to get weapons. And that's what they refuse to do. And, you know, when we talk about, places with strong gun laws, weak gun laws, Texas is one of those states, Nevada is one of those states, Arizona is one of those states where they make it very easy for people to get guns and take guns everywhere they go. But these are the states where we're now starting to see these horrendous, very public, very large mass shootings. How come where's their answer that, you know, as everyone in Texas carries guns and we're not going to see this here? Nope, everyone in Texas might carry guns, and we're seeing more of these incidents happening. And that's, you know, there are things we can do. Other countries have figured out how to deal with this situation. One of the president's comments, I think, yesterday or something, was that, you know, again, this is a mental health issue, and other countries have mental health issues. Yeah, well, we probably have the same rate of mental health issues that other countries do. Japan, I think, had 6 gun homicides all of last year. You know, I mean, that's a big country. That's not very many. We're the only industrialized, civilized sort of country in the world that sees this level of violence, and we're something like 25 times worse than anybody else. And it's because our politicians are unwilling to do anything more than offer prayers and moments of silence. I think it's horrendous. I think it's, this is something that people ought to be up in arms. If we treated terrorism this way, you know, if they said, oh, terrorists are evil, and evil will always be with us in the world, and if we make it harder for them to use planes, then they use trucks, and if we make it harder for them to use trucks, they use motorcycles. That wouldn't work. That wouldn't work. That wouldn't go over with the public. But that's what the politicians seem to expect us to buy when it comes to gun violence.
Well, just in closing, what can turn this around, this political paralysis?
It's going to take the people of the United States, across the United States, speaking up. It's going to take them joining groups like Brady or Moms Demand Action or the Giffords Law Center and fighting at all levels, fighting in the ballot box, fighting in the courts, fighting with public perception to say, let's do something. This is not about taking your guns away. This is about making our community safer. This is a public safety issue. This is a public health issue. This is something about let's have some common sense here. And it shouldn't be a partisan issue. It should be a common sense issue, and it should be one that we're working on solving instead of yelling at each other. And but it's only going to happen, I think, when the voters stand up, when the people stand up. And if you've got good electeds in your district now, great. Help those in other districts get somebody that's responsive to.
Well, Paul Helmke, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always enjoy talking to you. Thanks, Ian.
Well, thank you, Paul. And again, I've been speaking with Paul Helmke, who's a professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University and the former president of the Washington, D.C.-based Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, a nonpartisan grassroots organization leading the fight to prevent gun violence. He's also the former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and former president of the United States Conference of Mayors. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the impending default by oil-rich Venezuela.
Like the sun, you see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. And those people who put me down.
Sabana, porque está viejo y cansado. Pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Francisco Manaldi, who's a fellow in Latin American Energy Policy at the Center for Energy Studies in the Mexico Center and the Latin American Initiative at the Baker Institute, as well as a lecturer in energy economics at Rice University. He's also the founding director and a professor at the Center for Energy and Environment at IESA in Venezuela, and previously was a professor of political economy at the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello in Caracas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francisco Manaldi.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And last Thursday, President Maduro, in speaking to the nation, more or less admitted that Venezuela can't pay its bills. It's hard to believe that an oil-rich country sitting on about $15 trillion of oil wealth could be in the situation it's in now. But it does seem that it's in this situation largely because of Maduro, who has brought the country to its knees with a combination of corruption, mismanagement, and mindless ideology. So this is a massive tragedy. And is it going to get worse? Do you see a default looming?
Yeah, I mean, he announced that he wants to restructure the debt last week, and it's not clear exactly what he means. But clearly, I mean, they are having even trouble paying the last payments of this year. He announced that the money was flowing to a payment that was supposed to be done in November the 2nd, and it hasn't come yet. So that might trigger some default episode. So everyone is under the expectation that either Venezuela is going to default soon, or it will start a process of what they, you know, call restructuring, trying to, you know, get an agreement with creditors to change the debt, which is very unlikely due to the sanctions. So yeah, the situation is really dire. I mean, the country has dramatically compressed imports in order to be able to pay the external debt. Imports are about 80 to 85% lower than they were when the price of oil was at its peak in 2012. So the situation is really dramatic, and clearly the government cannot continue to pay the massive debt in which it has incurred.
But the human cost here is that people in the country are going hungry. When you say the imports, food is imported, for example, that means people are eating less. I understand people are getting thin, and it is extraordinarily tragic that people don't have the money to buy food because the money is going to Wall Street instead.
Yeah, I mean, this is unbelievable because, as you point out, this is a country that received the largest windfall in recorded history in Latin America until 2014. Almost $1 trillion in additional revenue. On top of that, it incurred insignificant additional debt. The country has a debt of about $120 and $130 billion. So it has spent all that money plus the debt, and now for the last 4 years has been in the worst depression actually in recorded history in Latin America. We don't have official figures, but it could be as bad as a decline of 40% of GDP per capita that has never been recorded in Latin America. Only a few other countries in the world with civil wars, mostly in Africa or Syria recently, have suffered a decline of that magnitude. And it will be the first country, the first OPEC country to ever to have hyperinflation. Inflation is reaching in hyperinflationary levels right now. So it's a debacle that we have never seen in an oil producing country, much less in a country with some of the largest oil reserves in the world.
But Maduro, in his speech last Thursday to the Venezuelan people, and he's deeply unpopular, and he pulled off a coup recently, but he did actually win regional elections because the opposition is kind of useless, as far as I can tell. And Donald Trump seems to have helped Maduro enormously by threatening to invade the country, which naturally, Venezuelans being patriotic, rally around the flag. But I want you to address those issues. But didn't Maduro's talk about the fact that they may have to default on bonds itself rattle the markets in Wall Street, etc., because he didn't seem to know the difference between restructuring and refinancing? I mean, without insulting bus drivers, this guy's a bus driver. He's not a financial wizard.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear what he meant to say, and if he, if he knew what he was saying. But there is no doubt that that they have dramatically changed in terms of the discourse with respect to paying the debt, and so that's why the market show extremely high probability that there is going to be actually a default, and maybe as soon as next week we will know if Venezuela is technically on a default, because the grace period of some of these bond payments is expiring. The situation has changed in that way, and it is true that both the statement by President Trump with respect to an invasion and the sanctions imposed to Venezuela, particularly the financial sanctions, have been the regime has used them as an excuse to sort of say. The U.S. is behind all our calamities, all our problems. And even though Venezuelans do attribute the responsibility to Maduro and the regime, most Venezuelans are against financial sanctions from the U.S. Because they perceive them as making the economic situation even worse. So that might have helped Maduro in the recent regional elections. It is unclear why a significant portion of the opposition abstain, if it's disenchantment or demobilization, but clearly the opposition is also having a lot of trouble mobilizing its base.
Well, let's turn to the Russians and the Chinese. Maduro has already mortgaged a lot of the oil to the Chinese. The Chinese seem to be more wary now of getting paid back. Russia has stepped in to fill the void, but in both China's and Russia's case, they've been getting oil in exchange for the money that's owed as opposed to giving new money. But the price of oil, I think, actually just spiked, went up, I think, $6 a barrel yesterday.
Yeah.
What's the macro picture there in terms of whether or not Russia will bail out Maduro?
Yeah, so as you point out, I mean, even though most of the debt is with China, Venezuela defaulted on China since a couple of years ago in de facto, and so the Chinese, in order to sort of formalize the situation, gave them a grace period in which they don't have to pay a capital, but just interest payments, and Russia gave some loans in the past 2 years to, and Venezuela owes Russia about $5 billion right now. becoming sort of the second largest single creditor to Venezuela. And the Russians have been much more active in getting involved into the Venezuelan situation, not only doing these loan deals, but also getting involved in new projects in the oil sector. The Chinese have been more cautious, have been much more willing to establish relationships with the Venezuelan opposition, saying that they are sort of politically not going to get involved, et cetera, whereas the Russians have been very aggressive and active. I mean, these two countries basically, by the way, Venezuela also defaulted on Russia de facto. I mean, it's not sending enough barrels, but still, the barrels that it's sending, it's around 600,000 barrels per day, which is a very significant magnitude if you consider that Venezuela's production has declined significantly in the last few years, and a similar amount is what Venezuela has been exporting to the U.S., which is, you know, the main source of cash, and because of sanctions, that's probably going to decline. So in the end, it depends on how Russia and China decide to manage this situation, if Venezuela will have some additional access to finance or not. It seems that they seem to be unwilling to provide fresh new loans. Of course, part of the reason why would they, you know, give money to Venezuela that then was going to repay bondholders in Wall Street? So maybe in the new situation there might be some deals happening.
Well, what's happening with the Venezuelan oil company, the PDVSA? It has a subsidiary here in the U.S., Citgo, and with considerable assets here in the U.S. And we know that the U.S., Texas, is where they've been able to refine the heavy crude that comes out of Venezuela. I'm not sure what the Chinese capabilities are or what the Russian capabilities are in terms of refining the heavy crude. But PDVSA came up in the Paradise Papers that were just released yesterday of offshore money being hidden by the global elite and oligarchs and kleptocrats, etc. Have you followed that? I'm not sure what the details were.
Yes, I mean, it appeared there, and in fact, you know, related to the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, there is a Russian company which he is involved that has dealt extensively with PDVSA, PDVSA. So yeah, I mean, PDVSA is in a very bad shape. Production has collapsed dramatically over the last few years, about 800,000 barrels. I mean, about a quarter of the production has declined, and it has only been saved by the joint ventures with some international companies, including the Russian and Chinese, but also some of the international private companies. And the situation is very difficult because they most of the oil that they export that earns them cash goes to the U.S. And as you point out, the U.S. has a lot of the capacity to refine the extra heavy oil. China and India do have some capacity. And in fact, what the Russians usually do is take the oil and sell it in the U.S. Or in India, in which the Rosneft bought a refinery in India to do that. Right. So it will be hard for Venezuela to divert all the oil that it's currently exporting to the U.S., to China and Russia. And so if sanctions or default make that hard, it will be an additional blow to the company, and it will probably mean a significant additional decline in production and revenues for the company, making it the situation harder.
And just in closing, of course, the vice president in Venezuela is charged by the U.S. being a drug trafficker, and Maduro insists on keeping him as being in charge of negotiations over debts to the United States. So that's not going to go anywhere. The whole situation is extraordinary that a country so rich could be in this situation. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Francisco Minaldi.
Glad to do it.
And again, I've been speaking with Francisco Minaldi, who's a fellow in Latin American Energy Policy at the Center for Energy Studies, and he's also a lecturer in energy economics at Rice University. He's the founding director and a professor of the Center for Energy and Environment at IESA in Venezuela, and previously was a professor of political economy at the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello in Caracas. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the results in the critical bellwether race for governor in Virginia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Quentin Kidd, who's a professor of political science and director of the Warren Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University in Virginia, where he teaches courses in American politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Quentin Kidd.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Quentin. It looks as though Ralph Northam, the lieutenant governor, the Democrat, has dodged a bullet, and he's looks like he's narrowly won. Is that your reading?
Well, it may be more than a narrow win. I mean, it's a 6-point win, but it actually might mean more than that because House of Delegates races, the state legislature, it looks like the coattails of that 6-point win are going to be really long, and Democrats may pick up as many as 12 seats in the House of Delegates. Nobody was predicting that, which means that 6-point win by Ralph Northam is really much more important for Democrats, I think, than it might somewhat appear if you're looking at the state from the outside.
And where's the percentage of votes in now? Because that earlier reports suggested it was tighter, but 6 points is a pretty healthy win.
Yeah, so right now we're showing about 82% of the vote in. Mm-hmm. And here's the way, if you look at Virginia on a map, if you just sort of visualize Virginia on a map, the vote comes in really west to east. The rural part of the state usually turns its vote in earlier, and then the more populous eastern part of the state turns its vote in later. And the last part of the state to return counts, is the populous suburbs of Washington, D.C., and literally a third, 38-39% of all votes come out of that area, and it's a heavily Democratic area. And so at the end of the night, usually the Democrat picks up some distance from the Republican, or picks up, you know, if they're trailing, for example, they gain some ground. Tonight what happened is Northam extended his lead as those Washington suburbs started reporting their numbers.
So Donald Trump is already tweeting saying that Ed Gillespie worked hard, but did not embrace me or what I stand for. So Trump, I guess, that's the opposite of taking credit, right?
Well, it's amazing. Didn't he tweet something completely opposite about 5 hours ago? I mean, so this is the real challenge that Republicans have going forward is Ed Gillespie's loss a repudiation of the fact that he didn't embrace Trump enough? Or is it a repudiation of the fact that he embraced Trump as much as he did? And of course, there's going to be a lot of debating on the Republican in Republican circles about that. But, you know, candidates, I can imagine across the country thinking about their campaigns in 2018, must be thinking, what do I do now? Do I embrace Trump or do I run from Trump? And the answer, quite frankly, isn't going to be clear, because Trump's going to argue what he just argued tonight, that you should embrace me more and you'll win, but the evidence just isn't clear.
So does, on the other side, the victor, Northam, the lieutenant governor. He, of course, defeated a more progressive candidate in the primary, Representative Tom Perriello. and he had to energize those supporters. Did they come out? And did they? And since he seems to concentrate so much on the white vote, what about the 20% of African Americans and growing Latino and Asian populations?
It looks like they all came out. African American vote looks like it's about 20% right now. The Latino vote looks like it might be 6 to 7% right now. And so I think the shadow of Donald Trump looms so large over this race that it was enough to salve any wounds that were hanging over from that primary. And I think that's essentially what happened tonight.
And when Stephen Bannon said, bring on the Confederate statues debate, this is a winner for us, for him and the sort of Tea Party caucus, the disruptors, or whatever you want to call them, it doesn't look as though that was a big factor, even though Northam did waffle on that issue, did he not?
Yeah, I mean, so Northam probably dodged a bullet here. He came out very strongly immediately after Charlottesville and said, take all the statues down. And then within 4 or 5 days, he started backing off on that. And I imagine that's because they polled on that issue and found that a majority of Virginians didn't want the statues taken down. They wanted things like historical context and, you know, stuff like that. And so Northam backed off of that really quickly, and he may have just dodged a bullet. He may have just backed off quickly enough not to alienate any of his less progressive base, because it looks like they all turned out to vote for him anyway.
Well, the fact that he voted for George W. Bush in 2004 is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, to win over the progressives, I don't imagine it's about winning over the progressives. This means that the progressives are motivated because of Trump, right?
I think that's exactly right. The shadow of Donald Trump looms large here. I don't think Perriello progressives and Bernie Sanders voters from 2016 came out and voted so much for Ralph Northam as they came out and voted against Donald Trump. The initial exit polls show that about a third of all Northam voters said they were sending a message of disapproval to the president. And I think, you know, that's probably what motivated a lot of progressives far more than their support for Ralph Northam.
And again, I'm speaking with Quentin Kidd, who's a professor of political science and director of the Watson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University in Virginia, where he teaches courses in American politics. So overall, this looks like a big win for the Democrats. And the opposite, of course, was a nightmare. The idea that it would have been a loss in Virginia would have been not just a psychological blow to the Democrats as they head into 2018, but it would have also been a ringing endorsement of Trumpism, since Gillespie ran such a negative campaign and accused Northam of being soft on pedophiles, etc. So how do you interpret it?
I think it provides a clear roadmap for Democrats. I'm thinking about 2018 here in the rest of the country. It provides a clear roadmap for Democrats and a more confused roadmap for Republicans. You know, for Democrats, essentially, Donald Trump becomes, in some ways, the sub-narrative of any campaign that they're going to run in almost any state in 2018. Obviously, Virginia didn't vote for Trump in 2016, and so we're sort of a different case study. But think of a Colorado or a Nevada. The narrative, it may be that campaign has a sub-narrative of Donald Trump more than Democrats would have been willing to do that had Ralph Northam lost tonight. And so I think the roadmap is a little more clear for Democrats. It's more muddled for Republicans.
So what do you think, though, is the way? I mean, obviously Trump is already basically trying to cover himself by suggesting that Gillespie didn't embrace him sufficiently and what he stands for. And is that a reference to Corey Stewart, who he ran against in the primary, that Gillespie ran against, who was a pro-Trump Tea Party type? In other words, had Trump's guy, or I guess Bannon's guy, would be a better way to put it, ran, do you think he would have done any better?
It's hard to see how he would have done any better. I mean, there just aren't enough, you know, there aren't enough Trump voters in Virginia. I think the reason Gillespie tried to split the difference is because there aren't enough Trump voters in Virginia to have gotten him any a better night than he got tonight. If he had run as a Trump candidate, embraced Trump, brought Donald Trump into the state to campaign for him, I don't know that that would have done any good for his, any better for his vote tonight, and it probably would have energized Democrats even more. And so, you know, I think Gillespie was in a tough spot no matter what. He needed to appeal to the base, which is a Trump-Corey Stewart base, and he needed to appeal to the moderate middle at the same time, and he couldn't do both. And ultimately, he tried to stretch his arms across to reach both of those, and he couldn't reach either one of them very well, and I think that's where the results are tonight.
But do you think the shameless nature of Gillespie's campaign, which had echoes of George H.W. Bush's campaign, and of course Gillespie worked for him in terms of you know, taking the low road, if you will, the Willie Horton road, did that backfire?
Yeah, I think it did backfire. I think what they were trying to do, you know, the ad that struck everybody as sort of an echo of Willie Horton, that ad ran about 5 weeks out. And I think what Gillespie's campaign realized was that they were really behind, and the only way they were going to catch up is if they could somehow depress that the vote that wasn't really attached to Northam. And so that progressive vote that was there because they didn't like Donald Trump, or the moderate vote that was there, you know, for whatever reason, didn't like Trump or whatever, but they weren't really tied to Ralph Northam. Negative ads a lot of times will depress those kind of voters. In the end, antipathy toward Donald Trump was a greater motivator than any frustration over the negative ads. And so it backfired completely on him, as we see tonight.
So just in summary, Northam, the Democrat, won handily, at least 6 points, maybe more. And he also, the Democrats picked up more seats in the House of Delegates, the state legislature. So a good night for the Democrats.
At minimum, a good night for the Democrats. Let's see where all of these House of Delegates races come out. Democrats are 17 seats behind in the House of Delegates. Republicans have a 17-seat majority. So Democrats have to have a long way to go to take back the House of Delegates. But right now they're at 11, maybe 12 seats. And so that's a pretty phenomenal night.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here this evening, Quentin Kidd.
Take care
yourself. And again, I've been speaking with Quentin Kidd, who's a professor of political science and director of the Watson Center for Public Policy at the Christopher Newport University in Virginia, where he teaches courses in American politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.